Let's come to what is the beginning of the close of the year. This is presentation 48 out of 52. We're looking at the parayana, a term that I have not just simply coined, but have brought back into play and into the English language from an ancient usage of the word in Sanskrit. In the remembered discourses of the historical Buddha, the major focus of his discourses was to impart a sense of the strategy of disinvolvement in the world to begin to hone a quality of concentration. In Sanskrit, that concentration is called dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A, dhyana. And it is a yana, it is a way. Dhyana is a way of concentrating by eliminating the superfluous and bringing into focus what remains. And the tremendous accuracy, not only of the Buddha, but of his method that he was imparting, that he was teaching, is that the extraneous begin to include almost everything down to a single point. And in Sanskrit, that single last point is called ekagrata. It is the last graspable, most minute vestige of focus. When the method perseveres, when the extraneous elimination perseveres, that ekagrata winks out. That space of no focus instantly shows that it is already vast spontaneously. And the word for that was nirvana. Just as it winks out, what winks back in to play is the world as it is, but seen with a further dimension. The dimension of a differential consciousness that knows that the context of whatever occurs, however minute, however complex, its context is this nirvana, vast, unlimited openness. So that the phrase enlightenment means that one has carried the way into not just the way in which one sheds light on something or other to whatever degree. There is an enlightenment that is the context in which all light, however unfocused, however focused, however in between in the entire scalar, that this is then a parayana. And the classical parayana was in 16 delivered sermons, as they used to be called. Sermiones in Latin is the English translation, sermons of the Buddha. They are actually a kind of dialogue that is a dialogue not with the listener as they are, but with the intuited vastness of the listener with themselves. That they are hearing the enlightened one, the Buddha, in terms of dhyana that has achieved a parayana, a way beyond, whatever focus or complexity the world may offer or be, potentially or active. But that parayana, that beyond, is actually a way across. And that way across is that there is another shore. One has left the shore, the certainty, the stability of the realm and the world that you grew up in and knew and matured to know very well, finally, or at least moderately well, that there is something that one goes to where that comes to a point, and that point disappears. But what does not disappear is the movement of that point, and that the other shore is a part of an advanced geometricity, a five-dimensional, if you will, a visionary way of giving a geometry. The quality of reminder for this is that the memory structure becomes more and more refined, more and more complex, until it achieves a master pattern that has a key, and it is that key, that symbol, as a master symbol, as a key that opens up the entirety of the memory structure. And what occurs then is that there is a spontaneous, new, fresh, conscious, differential dimension of being able to not utilize the memory, but to be engaged in creative remembering. And one of the symptoms, if you will, one of the symmetries is better, that goes with creative remembering, not the act of remembering, but the infinite field of conscious remembering. What is braided with it is creative imagining. And that creative imagining harkens back, just like the remembering harkens back to a worldly structure of complexity of the memory, creative imagining also harkens back to the imagination. So that in the human mind, in its sophistication, in its complexity, it can be educated to achieve a maturity where one has a very clear structure of memory at the same time as a very clear structure of the imagination, where all of the images are arranged. Arranged in filaments that are like image bases that are then woven together as the fabric that is indeed the world in its memorability, in its remembering through contact of sophistication with memorizing, and this is concomitant with the ability to read images for their meaning. That quality that is there in the memory gives a tone, classically, to the way in which the divisioning of the world through its images, through the images of action, of things, of thoughts, and that this division has a structure which can be then ordered and given a quality where one can learn not only to appreciate your memory, but you can increase it. You can make it more extensive, deeper, wider, handsome. And at the same time, that in Latin it's called divisio, that division of experience. There was a great book on Shakespeare by a woman professor many, many years ago. Shakespeare's a Division of Experience is exactly about that. I'll bring a copy next week. The divisio is braided with and always there with, in Latin, the term is compositor. It's the composition that braids with the division so that the memory and the imagination helps get into creative imagining at the same time that the memory has recourse to the much larger, more sophisticated quality of memory as remembering. The memory and the imagination in the limited mind can be educated. But to learn, one has to go across, one has to go beyond, so that learning is differential in its consciousness rather than integral in its education in terms of the world, in terms of the memory, in terms of the imagination, in terms of the society, in terms of your individuality, your gender, your religion, your politics, etc., etc. So that an education will help you do your job and achieve your ambitions and carry through your responsibilities, etc., etc. Whereas a little bit of learning shows that it has edges that are limits. All of them have limitations. And without pursuing learning, a little bit of learning, as the phrase goes in the world, a little bit of learning is a dangerous thing. Because if you leave off there with a little bit of learning, you tend to be able to see through other people's limitations and not your own. Other kinds of groups' limitations and not the one that you belong to. Other kinds of tribes, political parties, religions, etc., etc. Social communities, social levels, classes, genders. A little bit of learning introduces then something which has a regressive quality to it. Instead of being fed and nourished so that one continues to learn, the little bit of learning in its backsliding, its regression, not that it goes back, but that it remains a little bit. And it tends to curdle. It tends to become, first of all, becomes satiric. One can very easily turn it into a satiric comedian. crack jokes about. Or one can become acerbic in being super critical about it. They don't even know that they're wrong, and they're all wrong, and for the same reason, et cetera, et cetera. And so, by increments, that decay, as it were, that regression, as it were, sinks. It had a little bit of flash of creative imagining, of remembering, but came back to the mind, came back to being fit into a revised version of memory, the memory, a revision, an expansion, a little bit of this or that for the imagination, so that the imagery in the imagination that originally came out of the images from a mythic horizon that was a part of a natural cycle that had as its genesis the survival of life on all of its levels of complexity and development, that the actions that one would have to learn and take, be trained in, be shown, the things of the world and what one can do with them, what they are, the sense of one's individuality, one's own self, that is related intimately with one's group, whether it's the hunting group, the family group, the spatial tribal group, eventually the use of certain animals as amulets, as in totemic clans, et cetera, et cetera. All of this becomes subject to the increasing waves of distortion, of corruption, of regression. And more what becomes important is that the education of getting along in the world is adjusted so that the majority, the powerful, the influential, are the ones who then codify through doctrines, through declarations, through arguments, through their version of the divisio, their version then of the way in which this is the way that we compose. This is the composing, the composite. The high point complexity of that in the previous age, best to use as we are using the Greek term aeon, a 2,000-year period, a pair of millennia, four 500-year cycles of the phoenix, etc. The apex of that old age came just a couple of generations, two generations, a pair of generations before the new age came into play massively, but massively because it wasn't all at once evident in the world, evident to very few, but poignantly real, more real than all the complexities of the world. A learning invitation that went beyond the reigning power of educated doctrine, clans, groups, empire, because the dominant force at the time was a Roman Empire in the West, and a Han Dynasty empire in the east, and a quality of mishmash in South Asia, in India, and many competing little things together, and finally the sense that if you're not understanding in a deep way that the paring away leads to a single-pointedness, finally. And one can, in the old fashion, call it the self or the soul or I, with a single line with a dot at the top. Or you turn that single line with the dot at the top upside down, it becomes an exclamation mark. It is the quality that is a little bit of learning become a very complex, great learning, but not yet perfected, because it has not yet lost its I, its exclamation mark. It has still that to has a final coup de grace recourse that we will be triumphant. Our group, our empire will be triumphant. One of the last educated persons in Rome who had a glimpse that it was possible that the super ego person was not the complete end-all focus. His name was one of the few. Name was Cicero. And Cicero was the most powerful lawyer in Republican Rome. A Rome that was so complex it was only a military victory away from the Roman Empire. And Cicero was the greatest lawyer because the law courts administered in the Republic the Roman law matrix. That Pax Romana was in charge of the way in which Roman law had made the structure of what was educationally important to be in the memory, what was important to be included or excluded from the imagination, and that controlled it with like two hands the way in which the division of experience and the composing of further action, or what is to be remembered and what is to be eschewed, all of this came to a graphic, tragic end for Cicero. He was completely superseded by the power of Julius Caesar, because Julius Caesar was able to bring together and marshal together a mythos, a mythic horizon that coupled with the glory of Roman power that had spread the Republic to extraordinary ends. One of the ends was in the northern part of what was then Germany, and even began to extend the first step over the what has become the English Channel into the British Isles. Never completely successful by Caesar there, but tremendously successful in Germany. and began to bring to his service the very core of the Roman Republic power, which was an extension of the Roman law. The backup was the Roman legions, the military. And Caesar was the master of military strategy in his time. He was unbeatable, unbelievable. But he not only commanded at the apex, he was the final say. He was the Caesar. Later, the German word for that was Kaiser. Hail the Kaiser. Sound familiar in the 20th century? You bet. It is a quality that is constantly lurking there at the little bit of learning that increasingly is manipulated and manufactured so that there is a little bit of learning distributed very calmly, quietly, so that the general populace do not, cannot learn. One of the snags is that there's no limit to learning, because the field of differential consciousness in the vision of learning is infinite. It doesn't have limits. There's an appreciation of boundaries and thresholds, but not limits. The quality that comes up in later 20th century anthropology is a term that broaches upon this realization. The term is liminal. It's not about limits and therefore definitions and boundaries, etc. It's not unlimited, which is a conception that pairs itself with limit. Limit and unlimited are in Latin an opposition. They contrast in their comparison. But the liminal is all of the in-betweens which stretch into infinity. It is only by a mathematic that is able to access the liminal in its mathematic that delivers a most interesting transformation in civilization. And that is the realization that there is indeed a way to calculate which is not based upon measurement of limit and shying away from unlimitedness, but is accurate to whatever specificity of you want in between 0 and 1. But if you take 1 and 0, 0 the unlimited, 1 the limit of limitedness, and you pair them together, one gets a way of being pseudo-calculitic. And this is the binary that is used for computers. It is the hubris of a new age that has no idea whatsoever that the infinite liminality has a functional, workable freedom of composition and division. One can divide to any degree of specificity of micro that you want, or compose in terms of whatever macro one would like to explore. That's the original fresh basis of an interstellar civilization. So that a star wisdom humanity needs to have a moment of silence and humility where one can't recognize or identify anything, especially one's identity. And putting into a neutral gear the identification of your identity or anybody, anything's identity is a hiatus that spontaneously allows for fertility in an infinite field of differential conscious vision. Where learning is wide open, not permanently or forever, but just simply wide open. The quality of Cicero's tragedy was that in order to show demonstratively to all people who were still thinking that they were going to live in a Roman Republic. They were going to live in a republic because that's how it was founded some 750 years before by Romulus and Remus. Given its whole structure by Numa Pompilius, and here we are, and in order to serve notice to everyone who still lived in the imaginary Roman Republic, legionaries were sent to the villa of Cicero, and they not only murdered him, they cut off his hands. And they took those cut off hands to the Roman Senate, to the podium where one would make their speeches, and nailed those cut off hands to the podium. It so incensed those who felt this tragic denouement must be reversed, they assassinated Julius Caesar in front of the Roman Senate, many of them his closest friends, all of them stabbing him to show that as a group he was being murdered by his friends and his cohorts and so forth. Two people witnessed this with an eye towards succeeding where he had failed. The first was his right-hand man, Mark Antony, in his robust, manly, Roman Republic bred kind of declaration that I'm the man for the job, then now that Julius Caesar has been erased, I not only step into his shoes and toga, but I will remember how that worked and I will deal with it accordingly. He begged to be killed by legionaries on the outskirts of Alexandria when all of that went sour. Even had stepped into the bed of Cleopatra to take over from venerable Julius Caesar. The other person was his second degree nephew, Octavian, who became Augustus Caesar who saw to it that every aspect was covered, including making sure that the really profound mythic horizon was given a poetic structuring that would allow for a complexity that would be almost impossible for someone to not understand that it had its limitations. It had such a vast referentiality and complexity. That was Virgil in the Aeneid. But he also realized that there were, in addition to those qualities that Virgil could handle, and one of the aspects that he could handle showed a gap, a hole, a possibility, a mystery. And that was his section of the Aeneid that dealt with a visit to the Sibyl of Cumae. It was the Sibyls, those women, who were related, those nine Sibyls were related to the nine Muses, and they were related to the kind of ancient oracles largely brought together in a Pythagorean matrix so that the oracle at Delphi was sort of the head of the oracles, like the Sibyl of Cumae was the head of the Sibyls, so that the nine Muses had a head as Apollo, who was the way in which his harmonic grouped the nine together into a composition that with him was a perfect 10. And Augustus Caesar made it under the penalty of death for anyone to have a single page of an oracle, a muse, a sibyl that was not approved by the Roman Empire. Let's take a little break. The quality of the liminal between Cicero and Caesar is important. Cicero was masterful as the greatest lawyer in Roman history, republic or empire, and still was the way in which all cultivated students learning to read, to bring themselves into a cultural knowing, were based. And at the same time, they read Caesar. So that there is in Western development for those languages especially, including Latin, that are Latin derivative, there is a predilection to look at Cicero and Caesar as the divide of the Republic and the Empire. This is deceptive. Because we live in a world now, the global situation, where that really is in a minority. Not particularly de facto, because the spread of that European Roman ethos was global long before there was a sense of globality. But even then, it was undercut by an actuality in that the Latin language was an arbiter only of a choice. in between a lawyer-dominated republic and a military-dominated empire. The more potent languages in the world at that time were not Latin at all. In the West, there was Greek. In India, there was Sanskrit. In China, there was the Chinese language. And there was a quality in Africa of there being a wisdom of the forest. Not a jungle, but a wisdom of the forest. We talked last presentation about the experience of a British anthropological couple, Victor Turner and Edith Turner, who, when they finally got together in the Second World War, their first assignment as a couple, anthropologically, was to go into deep Africa. They went into what is now Zambia. And they lived for a number of years with the Ndembo people, the Ndembo tribe. And the classic anthropological, gorgeous monograph that Victor Turner brought out eventually that established his reputation worldwide permanently was about the Ndembo, and it was called The Forest of Symbols. It is the quality of the Ndembo that gave them the wisdom of Africa, the layered qualities that began to include that it is not the push of the person as an individual, or even of the collective of the tribe with its clans and so forth, genders, but that it was forest itself, it was Africa itself, that gave a visionary dimension to the reality of the community, and that the tribe was tutored by Mother Nature in the sense that she provided not a jungle, but a forest that also was able to be understood in terms of the distilled meaning of the symbols that one utilized in learning to be real. And unfortunately, Victor Turner died fairly young. He was just 63. And his wife, Edith, is still alive in 2014. And she went back to the Ndembo twice, once after about 20 years, after Victor passed away from cancer. She went back in 1985 and did a recounting of that, about the joy of learning to be real in Africa. And then she went back early in the 21st century to discover that the persons that she knew in the Ndembo, who were young at the time and becoming capable, viable, now were the, not the elder statesmen, but they were the visionaries that were keeping the tribe, the Ndembo people, real. And she was welcomed in such a way that after a couple of weeks with them, she wrote I was at last in my life finding that I was home. She had become an African. So the usage of Latin and its derivatives, whether in a judicial, quote, republic, or in a military imperium, is indeed a shrinking wedge, not in a very large pie, or even in a very interesting, complex sphere. But it is an illustrative quality of not just lessons, but of paths of inquiry and learning that disclose what was a great current behind that whole use of Latin. And the emphasis is not just on Greek, although one can initially say it is the complexities of Greek, the Greek language. But the development of Greek language was cognate with the development of Hebrew language. Both at the same time were tuned out of a language matrix that already by that time had more than 1,000 years of civilization behind it in complexity. The way in which to visualize it is that the beginnings of Greek as a very, very important language are in Homer, born about 1,000 BC. And cognate with Homer, one can put King David, so that David's Psalms and Homer's epics are tunable. And one of the great writers on this in the United States was Cyrus Gordon, whose little monograph, Homer and the Bible, very few people have read it. I happen to own a copy for many, many decades now. And I'll bring a copy, my copy, next week. But Greek was able to have an influence from Africa, because it was the Egyptian hieroglyphic wisdom of Africa that brought into play not just an esoteric, but a transcendent reach into a visionary differential infinity that initially was put into a very high poetic in Homer, and in succeeding developments of that Homeric Greek that led to eventually Renaissance figures from Pythagoras about 500 BC into the developments later from young men born in 500 BC. By 525 BC, there was a whole quality of new young men especially coming into play. In 525 BC, both Aeschylus and Pindar, the creator of Greek tragedy and the creator of Greek lyrical, classical, poetic, born at the same time, friends the rest of their lives. A Greek of Parmenides, etc. But born into that, the most poignant figure was a woman. Her name was Diotima, and she was from Mantinea in the Greek Peloponnese, south of the Gulf of Corinth, that long gulf separating the continental mainland from the peninsula-like appendage of Greece. Mantinea is about halfway in Acadia down the way. Another coastal city not far from that was Patria, and that's where St. Andrew finally ended up and passed away there. But Diotima of Mantinea carried with her a rare feminine mitochondrial DNA of the Pythagorean visionary discovery that there is a cosmic mysteriousness that, while it can be approached expressively, if really approached expressively, it discloses the openness. Remember, we began with the openness of the historical Buddha, that beyond all of the getting rid of the extraneous, there is a final single point that can be as well not gotten rid of, but which disappears. Disappears not elsewhere, but disappears in upon itself, so that there is a openness which is perfect. That perfect open field of infinity falls in love with a zero field of nature. That's a hierogamos to be beheld. She was the teacher of Socrates. She matured him away from all of the dispositions that he had before that were characteristic of him. We needn't go into them now. One of them, he was married to a shrew, Xantippe, and so he hated to stay around the house and went down to the forum in the Agora in Athens and held out and loved talking to the young men. And that's how Socratic method began to take hold. He learned that from Diotima. He also learned that this cannot take place unless there is a falling in love in the learning, which gives a added dimension of differential conscious vision to the way in which the dialogue shifts from an argument of cases, like in law, or an imperial enforcement of the doctrine, to a mutual inquiry that in the interplay, as the sense of companionship and companionability begins to mature, one begins so that the opinions of the opposition become refined opinions of a very informed opposition, become a quandary of unknowing, which finally discloses itself as an eureka, that's it, shared realization, that both pro and con, finally, in that third refinement, come to see together the point of actuality, which, given the nature and the consciousness of reality, disappears upon in itself and leaves a vast, infinite field of consciousness, so that there is such a thing as a mystery that has been disclosed, which turns out to be very Egyptian, which turns out to be very African, which turned out to be an incredible insight into the origins out of which Hebrew came, the North Semitic languages, all together at the same time as the birth of Linear A, the forerunner of Linear B, used in the Minoan level, Mycenaean level, into classical Homeric Greek, so that there came to be an African Hellenistic Judaism in Alexandria, which was extraordinary because it was liminal all the time everywhere and was exploring in those resonances in a harmonic which to almost all others seemed invisible or improbable or who knows, speculative, whatever. And meantime, it became the birth of a new age, the birth of a new aeon, but not right away there, but brought there very quickly as a focus, like an implosion of powers that produced not a fission, but a fusion. Not an atomic bomb or even a hydrogen bomb, but something much, much more interesting. It became the seed out of which a whole new aeon would develop. And so there are resonances that happen there. And within two generations, within about 50 years, it went back to the cognate different sources of this ocean, tracing back the major rivers and streams and going back to the highlands, as it were, metaphorically, from which they sprang. In 41 AD, about 50 years into it, a trio of writers who had been with that initial seed. One was named Matthew, became Saint Matthew. He went back to Ethiopia. Another was Saint Thomas. He went back to India. The third was Saint Philip. And he not only went to what was then Roman Asia Minor, to Ephesus, but eventually carried that all the way to France. And a fourth who was a hearer along with them, his name was James, Saint James, went to northern Spain. So that all of a sudden one had this reaching out back to ancient sources. This quality dwarfs the Cicero Caesar, the Republic of legal power and argumentative technique to be convincing and take the day, or an imperium, an empire that administers its application of doctrine matrix refined to the nth degree of order. That is a false conundrum. That's a shadow puppet play, which various Weiyangs conduct in the night of the species, throwing shadows against a temporary screen, like in Plato's great dialogue, Socratic dialogue, The Republic, the myth of the cave. That we are seated facing a cave wall that is illuminated by a fire behind us, and that certain persons carrying carved images pass in between and cast shadows against the wall, and we think that we're watching what's going on in the world and do not know that we are captive to a shadow puppet play, being manipulated by who knows, for who knows, etc., etc. But that there comes a moment where someone on the bench turns around and sees the parade of the cutouts and the fire and realizes that something else is going on here. The Greek word for that turning around is metanoia. It's a turning around in the mind from the hypnagogic quality of the play of the shadows in the false light and realizing that one is not chained at all to the bench. You can get up from the bench, you can turn around, and you can leave and find your way out of this cave into, for the first time, the outdoors. And whether it's night and you behold the stars, or it's day and you behold the sun, is indeed a new day. A metanoia is the trigger by which that works. That initiates learning as opposed to inculcation, as opposed to an education, no matter how refined, is within limits that have been defined, identified, even recognized, but not real. Just as real as thinking the unlimited is vacuous, nada, nothing, no thing, an abyss, etc., etc. Those are false dichotomies before the court of convincing, before the struggle with the new world order, however phrased. Whether it's that world of a world or that world of a whole pattern of star systems, it's still simply that. The quality of realizing that metanoia in a very poignant way in Western civilization came after 1,000 years of what was called, not too long ago, when I was a little boy, it was still called the Dark Ages. Because the light of the empire had gone out in a dramatic way. The sack of Rome by Alaric in 410 AD erased permanently the idea that there was any kind of power to the Roman Empire at all ever again. And they did a shift of guilt and of assuming power to the other Rome, Constantinople, to Byzantium. And they finally came to understand that the energy had gone out of the old wisdom. Rome was dead, its empire was dead, and we are now piecing together a new mosaic of the icons that we will make archetypal of all of our images and image base, and we will have a doctrine on the basis of these mosaics of icons, and this will convey to anyone who comes to wanting a glimpse of more than just what is before us. This will satisfy that taste, and we can move on from there. And the old, by that time, had atrophied, so that the academy that Plato had founded in Athens closed like a bookend, with 525 BC being the birth of Aeschylus and Pindar, and 525 AD were the closing of Plato's academy, not through any kind of coercion or destruction, there just weren't any more students. And the last teacher died in jail. His name had three Latin preludes, Ancius and so forth, the family, and his last name was Boethius. His classic work still extant because it had been translated all the time, kept in Latin or translated into other languages, the consolation of philosophy, the consolation of the love of wisdom. That those who are in love with wisdom, they form a community that transcends space and time, that shares vision, shares the art of learning, shares a much larger liminal resonance of history, and comes into possession of an analytic that is real science, so that the cosmos can be not only understood analytically, but appreciated aesthetically. And in this, there is a quality that comes into play by reopening a Platonic academy. Not in the ancient Athens, but in Florence, Italy, northern Italy. Cosimo de' Medici had a favorite yellow plastered brick villa, the Via Careggi, and he donated the villa to the development of a Platonic Academy, because he had raised as a little boy the son of his personal physician. And at that time, in the mid-1400s, the quality of a physician was a little bit different from what we have understood in our time and previously. That by the mid-1400s, the quality of a physician was that they understood the tragedy of life poignantly enough to be able to continue to treat in a therapy others who might be spared not just their death immediately, but to be more poignantly spared the tragedy that a real physician comes to understand about people, about persons, bodies, minds, imaginations, memories, but especially their lives and love. The great bearer of this was a magnificent high medieval epic called The Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. That was a way to bring the Homeric epic quality not to the Iliad of Virgil and the founding of the Roman Empire, Imperium. But the way in which a high Middle English poetic was able to be at home, not just in an English language, Britain, but to be at home in a French language, France, an Italian language, Italy, and to be able to reach out and become humane. And so the structure of the Canterbury Tales is not only the sense that there are 12 stories, 12 tales to be told in the first half of the Canterbury Tales, and then 12 stories to be told in the second half, but that the total number in this pilgrimage from London to Canterbury, from the London of the power of the island to the introduction of a Roman imperium quality of so-called Christianity about the time of St. Augustine, about the 400s, about the time of the sacking of Rome. But that pilgrimage was like an ancient wisdom going back to not just the Homeric epic in the Greek, the high classical Greek, but going back to the quality that is there in the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic, the Book of the Caverns in hieroglyphics is about the 12 gates that one must pass through in the netherworld to be reborn the next day into a day of 12 hours. And so the full 12 hours and 12 hours is that day. And next week we'll talk about how there were 30 pilgrims, and the 30th pilgrim is the teller of the tales as an interlocutor of hearing from the others in their order, but put into a mysterious, a via mysteriosium. This is one of the keys to the last four of the Parayana presentations. Next week we begin.